Coming up next on Tech News Today, WhatsApp is getting all sherry with Facebook suddenly. Also, Nextdoor is attempting to be a little less racy. How to increase the number of women computer science majors. We'll talk a little bit about that. Also, a sophisticated exploit of iOS has resulted in an emergency patch by Apple. And finally, painting your music video with Prisma. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1585, recorded Thursday, August 25th, 2016. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/TNT. And by Igloo Software. Igloo is an intranet you'll actually like. It connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is a show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories with people who are awesome and passionate about technology. I'm Jason Howell, and this guy, who is this guy? Are you Megan?
Yeah.
You've changed.
I've got 10.
I've been meaning to tell you, Megan, you've changed.
I've gained a lot of weight.
Megan is actually out.
If
you hadn't heard, she is not here, and in Megan's place is Father Robert Ballister. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
it's always my pleasure to get you on the show, because then I don't have to panic about who I bring on, and you're awesome. So there we go. Let's talk about a few tech news stories to start the show off here. First of all, so Facebook bought WhatsApp back in 2014, and one concern users had was when, not if, Facebook would begin to share data on its users between the two services. At the time, WhatsApp founder Jan Kwam wrote that personalized data on its users wasn't collected or stored by the service and that the company didn't intend to change. Now, and what proves that wasn't such an ironclad guarantee, WhatsApp is telling its users via its privacy policy that it will start to share analytics data between, or including user phone numbers between them and Facebook. So apparently businesses are going to be able to contact WhatsApp users through the platform. This is something that Facebook's already been doing, kind of rolling out and, you know, to dismay on some people's parts, I'm sure, to Messenger users. What do you think about this?
This kind of makes my heart break a little bit because you've got these companies who they grow big on a promise.
Yeah.
And the promise is almost always, we will not treat you like our product. We will treat you like our customers. You will be our valued clients, the people who we work for. And eventually, they have to go into money-making mode. And unfortunately, anytime a company flips over to money-making mode, they have to do things like sell customer data, which is why all the pundits, when this deal was first announced way back when, were saying there's no way that they can deliver on their promise. They said they will never share customer data. Well, If you're an internet company, that's the only way you get paid. Unless there's a subscription fee, you have to do that, especially if you're going to be part of the Facebook empire, which is based entirely off of big data analytics of that customer data.
Yeah, or maybe not a subscription fee. Maybe it's ads, like third-party ads. But, I mean, WhatsApp basically says this prevents things. What they're doing here prevents things like third-party banner ads and spam. And I'm assuming what they mean is, so you're welcome. but I don't know how people feel about that. WhatsApp has a history of focusing on privacy and individual liberties and that sort of stuff. They've been a source for people who are concerned with that sort of stuff for a long time. So this is definitely an about face.
Well, this is an interesting thing for the security community. And it's not just WhatsApp. It's not just Facebook. The question is, can you be dedicated to customer privacy? Can you be a company that is responsible about the personal identifying information of the people who use your service and still be a company that participates in a regular economy? Mm-hmm. And there have been a couple that have tried to do that. They've really, really made an effort, But eventually they either go away because they went bankrupt and no VC is willing to pour money into a hole, or they start to say, okay, well, we're going to sell some of your data, but not the most important data. And now you could look at this and say, well, look at the data that they're actually providing. It's not really super special data. It's data that they could find elsewhere.
Yet.
But even then, yeah, as a user, if and this is why I never use WhatsApp, I'd say, no, I'm betrayed. Mm-hmm. You gave me a promise, and that's why I helped you become big. And if you're going to go back on that promise now, I want nothing to do with you.
Yeah. The Electronic Privacy Information Center apparently is filing a complaint. They say if the FTC does not bring an enforcement action, it means that even when users choose better privacy services, there is no guarantee their data will be protected, which is kind of what you were saying there. So, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like I said, when, not if. Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't want to be negative Nelly on this. This is a company that's still trying to do something responsible. And yes, sharing data is that's part of the internet currency.
Sure.
And even if it's a company like Facebook, which they don't get their money by overtly selling your information. They sell your information because they target ads against you.
Mm-hmm.
So how much do you value the service and how much of your privacy are you willing to give up? And it always comes down to that. And
for sure.
People who thought that WhatsApp would be a different kind of company, sorry, no.
That probably went out the window when a giant company like Facebook ended up buying them. The writing was kind of on the wall. When you think of the DNA of Apple as a company, social doesn't always sit very high on the list, thanks to history. So I'm not sure what to feel about today's rumor published by Mark Gurman on Bloomberg that Apple's working on a video creation app that would supplement services, social services like Snapchat, while bringing Apple some mind share from younger users. Apparently, that's kind of a big part of this, is kind of, you know, targeting some of their future offerings to those younger users. In competition with like Snapchat and the others. This would run on current iPhone and an iPad models. The user would record a video and tell me if this sounds familiar, apply filters or drawings to the video, and then send to contacts. But using the social networks, when I first kind of dove into this, I was like, oh man, Apple and social networks, that's not, you know, that's like oil and water based on, you know, history like Ping inside iTunes and stuff. But the more I kind of thought about this, the more it really seems less like a social network and more like a tool designed for use with social networks.
Yeah, this kind of puzzled me, because if this really actually is their big social push again, it seems like a really bad social push.
Like a weak.
It's super,
approach.
Super weak. Yeah. It's one of these things where, like, oh, so it kind of takes things that other services do and does a slightly worse job at doing them. Okay.
Maybe not worse, but it does those same things
on its
own. It's, and then you have to ask yourself why you do that instead of the other.
Why can't Apple get social right? I mean, they get so many other things right, but this has been the thorn in their side.
Yeah.
From the very beginning, They've been telling people that the only products that they release are encouraging people to leave the world that they currently exist in, mm-hmm. in order to enter the Apple ecosystem. And it's like, wait a minute. No, you know that doesn't work, because that's how you get your users. That's your diehard users. In order to get out there, you have to complement something that they're already using, not say, abandon that, come with us.
Maybe that's part of what they're doing here. One source, sources were saying that basically it would begin as a standalone app, but that maybe eventually it would be built into the camera app, which as I was reading through it, I was like, oh, this sounds like camera functionality. Like, I feel like to a certain degree, Android has edit tools in the photo app that does a lot of this stuff that you could do. And it's just built into the camera app. I don't think of it as a social tool. I just think of it as editing tools for my video. Yeah. So to a degree, that's part of what this would be. If it happens, it's in preliminary stages right now. Could be killed off, targeting a 2017 release. But Mark Gurman also had sources talking about another kind of set of features that do more kind of work within the social realm, features to kind of bring sharing into the OS level. So, and I feel like on Android does this well. Sharing is very much ingrained and built into the OS. So I don't know how that works on the iOS side of things, but proactive assistance will see some improvements that would basically bring like clarity to the communication that you have with one contact in all these sort of ways, kind of like a single view of all of your communication, be it whatever service it happens to be on, in one view with this person, kind of built into the OS.
That's what I used to get with Hangouts. That doesn't really happen anymore, but okay. And I could see that. I could actually see the use for doing something like bringing all the different contact systems that you have together.
Yeah.
That would be useful. I don't really think that's a killer feature. But I could see this being the long game where Apple's saying, look, we're going to build these features into the various functions of the phone, of the operating system. And eventually people might figure out, oh, hey, rather than me doing three steps, there's a button here that lets me do it in one.
Mm-hmm.
That I could see as being doable, but that's a very slow game. And I don't know if Apple's into slow games.
Sure. Nextdoor, the social network based on the neighborhood in which you live, has had its fair share of criticism when it comes to reports of racial profiling by its users. Reports in 2015 showed how users would often report suspicious activity simply by there being a person of color in the neighborhood, with no mention of any actual crime being committed by them. Simply the fact that they were there was cause enough to alert others. Well, Nextdoor says that this type of action, quote, runs counter to the mission of Nextdoor. It's something it's something we feel morally obligated to take seriously. And with that, today they've launched a new algorithmic approach to facilitate the reporting of crime and safety concerns that identifies terminology that might be racially loaded and actively prevents that posting unless further information is provided. So basically what they've done here, they've kind of worked groups, advisors, all sorts of different groups, local police, city governments, public agencies, to figure out the best way to approach this. They were leaving it so wide open before, so really all you could put the bare bones minimum information there and still publish it and everyone would see it. Now it's meant to mirror the way the details are obtained by 911 dispatchers and police reports, so it's a lot more specific. Explicit requests for things like height, clothing, age, hair. Race is included as one of the options, but it's not front and center. It's there as yet another feature, and there is a requirement of more information than just race, basically.
I like it. I like the movement, but at the same time, it feels a bit like putting a Band-Aid on a gaping chest wound.
Mm.
If the technology itself is helping to filter out racial profiling, that doesn't change the fact that that people who reported it were still racially profiling. And if you're not fixing that, all that's going to happen is at some point someone's going to get very frustrated because it always seems as if the police don't act on their tip because the service filtered it out.
Right.
So while I applaud this, I mean, this is really the only thing that they can do. It's not a technological solution here. This is a social solution.
But it has algorithms.
I know. Ideally, in a true world, algorithms would be perfect because they are impassionate. They just do what they were programmed to do. They follow math. Yeah. But we are not math and we are not equations, and people make mistakes and they get scared and they do silly, silly things.
Sure.
So to say that, oh, well, there's no racial profiling on our service is false. It's we are doing a really good job of removing reports that we think are racially profiling.
Yeah.
And that actually covers up the bigger problem.
Better than nothing. And actually, they've been running tests internally. They say it's shown a 75% reduction in racial profiling that they've detected by users with this option, this feature, whatever you want to call it. Also decreased the number of posts regarding crime and safety issues. So, and I mean, I think that's actually kind of a pretty important part right there, right? It's almost like the boy who cried wolf. It's noise at a certain point. If you're reporting all of these things, these non-crimes as crimes, then the system becomes less trustable. But if there is an option like this that actually cuts down the reporting of crime, then you can trust what you see maybe a little bit more, perhaps.
Right, but does the algorithm just start not accepting reports from
right?
Like if one person is submitting 400 reports a day because they see scary people, does the system just say, okay, well, you can submit, but they don't go anywhere?
Right.
Because now you've created another problem. You've created the problem of you're now cutting off entire parts of your user base because they're not trustworthy, but you're not telling them that they're not trustworthy.
Right.
You know, maybe there should be a feature where after a certain number of reports, it just says, man, you racist.
In big block letters and then account deleted or something. I don't know.
There you go.
Uber isn't yet public, but still holds financial performance calls every quarter. And on Friday, the company shared a number of eyebrow-raising details. The first quarter of the year saw Uber lose around $520 million. The second quarter saw that number shoot up passed $750 million. The U.S. in particular saw a shortfall of around $100 million, which brings Uber's total losses for 2016's first half to around $1.27 billion. The company told investors that the cause of these losses was primarily the company's subsidies for Uber drivers. But bookings were up by $5 billion in that time from $3.8 billion, and net revenue grew 18% to around $1.1 billion in the second quarter. That's lots of millions and billions there. But I think the overall summary here is that Uber continues to lose money quarter after quarter. How long can they keep this up?
I love this story. It's like, okay, the profit loss is, I mean, the losses are increasing, but bookings are up.
Yes.
So yeah, we're losing money on every booking, but we're booking even more than ever.
Yeah, which means we're losing even more than ever.
You know, this kind of reminds me of Amazon in the early days.
Yeah, it does.
Where Amazon was always losing money. But here's the difference. We now know that the reason why Amazon was losing money quarter after quarter after quarter was because they were investing all of their profits, or kind of profits, back into the infrastructure, and now they're a crazy profitable business because they built AWS.
Mm.
Uber doesn't have that. They're not building out an infrastructure. They're just trying to run a business, and they're losing money on every transaction. Now, where they go from here, there's a couple of ways. A, they can start paying their drivers less, which the drivers won't want, and they'll go elsewhere.
Right.
Or B, they can start looking at things like, well, we'll move to driverless cars, which they are doing. You can take this two ways. Either this is a transition time and Uber is going to slowly transition into profitability, or we're seeing the slow death of a company, of a unicorn.
Think Uber can lose like this because investors, you know, understand that the long term. I think your B is yeah, probably right. I mean, is what's happening right now is that Uber kind of, they're in accumulation mode, yeah, right now. Accumulation of users. We want to get people in the habit of using Uber and blah, blah, blah. They're losing all sorts of money right now because they've got this fleet of drivers everywhere, and that's costing them an arm and a leg. But yes, the long game, and who knows how long that is. Maybe it's more near term than we think, but their, you know, grand plan is driverless cars, cars that drive themselves, cars that don't need people in them, less people to pay, make lots of money.
Right, yeah. And I remember there was an interview with some of the Uber founders just a long time ago, and I caught a very small part, but they were joking. They said, well, ideally, we wouldn't want to have a driver. But that was real. That's actually real. The strategy. That's always been the strategy of Uber from the beginning, which is as the technology increases, we want to be a new kind of cab company. And a new kind of cab company doesn't have a driver.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this is just the investors understanding. You put money in this long enough, and eventually when they get rid of all the drivers, they're going to be an insanely profitable company.
You compared Uber to Amazon, and I'll just go ahead and say this. Amazon, like you said, they built their company like this. In its worst year, that was the year 2000, they lost $1.4 billion in 1 year. Uber is at $1.2 billion
so
in half
the
year.
To go.
So,
yeah,
you know they're going to win. They're going to win that game,
they're
whatever
ahead of the
it
game.
Is. Exactly. Wow. All right, coming up, one college is churning out an abnormally high number of female computer science graduates. We're going to talk about that. But before we get there, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They are the sponsor of this episode. If you've ever gone through the process of doing a mortgage, it comes with its joy, which is the house that you live in. It comes with its sorrow, which is all the paperwork you got to dig up all over the place. It's not very fun. But Rocket Mortgage makes it a little bit easier for you. They bring the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. Fast, powerful, and completely online, Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. So if you don't like searching through stacks of old files and paperwork, I'm sure there are some people who like that. I don't, and maybe you don't. With Rocket Mortgage, you don't do that. You can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button, helping you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. And even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you do all this with the phone that you have in your pocket or your tablet. You can do it on the couch. It's a quick online process that you can manage from anywhere, basically, in your pajamas even, while you're sitting on the couch watching TV. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or to buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. Okay, so statistics have shown that women account for only 16% of all undergraduate computer science majors, but one college in particular apparently knows how to change that. Joining us to discuss this is Oliver Staley from Quartz. How's it going, Oliver?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. It's great to get you on today. So give us a quick rundown here on Harvey Mudd College and where it stands when it comes to female computer science graduates.
So, yeah, as you mentioned, they've sort of unlocked the secret of how to keep women in computer science and graduate them. And for the first time this year, they had more women than men graduate with majors in computer science. 55% of their computer science majors were women. If you factor in joint majors, it's slightly less, something like 49%. But still, it's a really significant number. And as you mentioned, nationally, the number is around 16%. And that number hasn't really changed. It's actually come down a little. It peaked a little bit higher at one point. So yeah, Harvey Mudd is doing a really good job at this. And they've done it by sort of really working hard at it. It didn't happen by accident. They made it a priority, and they worked at encouraging, first of all undergraduates are required to take a computer science course. I don't know if you don't know, Harvey Mudd is entirely students in science and engineering, so it's not unusual for them to be required to take this course. So all women are initially exposed to computer science. And they separate the freshmen into three tracks. So there is an opportunity for women who have absolutely no experience, and men as well, who have no experience in computer science to take a sort of introductory course. And that's what they found, is that's really helpful because it sort of reduces the intimidation factor. So the women in it and men are not as they're not sort of thrown in the deep end with people who have been studying this stuff for years. And so they can sort of ease into it, and they change the programming language. So they don't use Java, they use Python, which I'm told is an easier language. And they changed they made the course more team-based and more participatory and more project-based to make it more engaging to people. And they did something that was interesting, which is they sort of encouraged the know-it-alls in class, which in some cases were men, to keep their hands down, not to take up all the airtime in class talking and showing off. They don't want to discourage people from having ideas, but they asked the men doing that to do it offline in office hours so women could have sort of more opportunity to talk and again, wouldn't feel shut down. And that has slowly had an impact over the years. They've also, it's a university, a college that has a lot of women professors. The president is a woman. You just saw a picture of her there, I think. She has been really instrumental in driving this forward.
It really seems like, I mean, we talked a lot on this show, you know, in the technology space about, you know, things like inclusion, just as you know, a way of making the environment less—I don't know if the right word is hostile—but more, you know, more compatible with all sorts, you know, all people from all walks of life, instead of just being targeted at one particular demographic. And then, you know, the whole idea behind inclusion is like you almost feel shut down in that scenario if that doesn't necessarily gel with your background. Really seems like that's something that they've got going here that works in the university level. Is there a risk for graduates moving on from this kind of environment out into the workplace where it might not be as hospitable?
Yeah, I know. I think there's always that risk when anyone goes from sort of a comfortable environment into the real world. But I don't know that that would be different from going from a school like Harvey Mudd than from any other small liberal arts college. Sure. Where you're thrown into the deep end of the work world. One thing the president told me is that their women tend to find jobs in larger employers like Google's and Facebook's versus startups, because those are more predictable work environments where there might be more kind of scaffolding to support women in their careers versus the kind of rough and tumble eat your own environment of a startup.
Oliver, quick question here. So
sure.
It sounds as if the experiment is basically about encouraging self-confidence. It's giving people the ability to, and the environment, the safe environment for them to say, hey, you know what? I actually know this. I'm not the bottom of my class. I'm not that the crippled kid who can't understand any of the concepts that are being explained. But do we eventually, in this experiment, get past that point? Do we get to a point have to encourage self-confidence? It just comes with the territory.
Right. So, you know, basically what it is I think you're not wrong, but I would phrase it slightly differently in that it's about reducing attrition. You know, basically, the problem has been that women just find reasons to drop out of computer science. They either feel pressured or uncomfortable, or they just find other things they like better. And what they're trying to do is encourage a kind of enthusiasm and love of the subject so that the women who actually are really suited for it stay in it versus sort of fall out. And so, so after that first semester, they become sort of the three tracks, start funneling into one. And by the time they decide to become computer science majors, there's no difference in the tracks, and they're just, you know, they're in the deep end with men and everyone else. And also one of the things the school encourages is after the freshman year for women to take internships or research opportunities to really get a sort of exposure to the world of computer science. So the idea here is that they take the training wheels off pretty quickly, and they're just, you know, they're in the mix with everyone else. But it's that initial kind of introductory process that can be so intimidating, and historically has left a lot of women feeling like this was not for them.
Okay, I'm absolutely with that. I understand that. I've done teaching, so I understand how important that beginning part is, because you can quickly either entice a student or turn a student off entirely from a field. But playing devil's advocate, there are going to be members of our audience who are going to say, wait a minute, why would we do this? I mean, the men in the class are being exposed to the same know-it-alls. The men in the class get the same environment. So are we creating a false environment, one that's not going to exist outside of the classroom, one that won't exist in a larger university? Is this experiment repeatable?
Well, yeah, we don't know. I mean, what we do know is that a lot of colleges are want to learn from Harvey Mudd, and they've created an initiative with, I think there's now 16 colleges in it, some very big universities like Arizona State and some smaller ones who are trying to borrow from this model and encourage women. There may be another way to do it, but nothing else has really proven to work. So why not try this? It's a little hard to track the career. It's a little early to track the career progress of all the women who have gone through this, but they are getting jobs. They're staying in those jobs so far, and they seem to be flourishing their careers. So it does seem to be working. I guess is the argument that they're somehow stunted by this experience? I mean, maybe some are, but you know, I think the world might be better off with slightly stunted computer scientists than no computer scientists who are women.
Yeah, that's true. And another kind of interesting fact about taking this and applying it onward is that Harvey Mudd College is actually relatively small. It's like 800 students in total. And you said that they're working to kind of scale this out. Some of the other kind of potential universities that are working on this, are they much larger? Or kind of format that only works for a smaller place?
Oh, I think it helps that it is at a smaller place.
Sure.
But Arizona State is an example of it's one of the biggest universities in the country, and they are part of this initiative. They're not a school I've talked to about this, so I don't know how they're implementing it, but I do know that they're part of the initiative. It's a lot of universities have schools of engineering, so you could have a small college within a big university, and it might be easier to replicate. Mm-hmm. I think one of the challenges here, though, is again, like Harvey Mudd, computer science is mandatory for every freshman at Harvey Mudd, so you can't get out of it. And so they're able to, they have sort of a captive audience, and since they can sort of inculcate them in kind of nurturing and encouraging computer science environment, they're able to retain them. Another school where that's not the case, where there isn't a mandatory computer science class, women may just choose not to sign up and they'll take something else. So I think, frankly, one of the keys to Harvey Mudd's success is that mandatory component. Since every woman is taking computer science, they have an opportunity to reach every woman in the college.
Sure. Oliver, what's success here? If you start looking at the program in 2-3 years and maybe it expands, is it just having a higher retention rate of women in computer science? Is it increasing the number of women in the workforce in IT? What would you consider to be sort of the level at which we could say, yes, this works?
Well, I think it's how when we start seeing women reaching leadership positions in tech, frankly, you know, when startups are run and funded by women, when the big companies are run by women, or at least, you know, a fairly representative amount of women. I don't think a world of 100% women CEOs is any better than a woman of 100% male CEOs, but I think the world would be a lot better off if we saw equal representation at the highest levels. And we started seeing more women persisting in their careers. I think a big concern is what happens when women reach sort of their late 20s, early 30s, and they have, you know, are they able to have a family and stay in their careers? That's not just a tech challenge. That's a challenge for all industry. But, you know, what's one of the reasons we don't see a lot of women CEOs is because there's been a lot, they aren't able to maintain their careers through their family rearing ages.
Right. And all the pressures that come along with that, societal and otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really want to thank you for coming on and sharing your thoughts on this story. Oliver Staley is at Quartz. Tell people where they can follow all your work online.
So it's easy enough to QZ.com. You could follow me there. There you go. And you can follow me on Twitter at O Staley.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Oliver. Have a great night.
Okay. Thanks a lot, guys.
We'll talk to you soon. All right, up next, the story behind Apple's latest patch for iOS, and it's quite intriguing. But before that, let's take a minute to thank Igloo Software, the sponsor of this episode. Work is no longer a location. Teams can be together half a world away. Igloo is a modern intranet designed to keep everyone on the same page. You can share files, have real conversations in real time, and do it all while being able to use the apps that you currently use, like Box, Google Drive, and Skype. Igloo brings everything together and creates a single destination that lets you focus on your work. It's a cloud platform that helps you share files, collaborate on documents, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage projects. Anyone can add content based on their permissions with drag and drop widgets and WYSIWYG editor. Igloo also offers a variety of access, authentication, and identity services to ensure that only authorized users have access in private clouds, over SSL, and with 256-bit encryption. Now, unlike other solutions, you can customize Igloo to fit your needs and work with your current IT investments like Office 365, Salesforce, SharePoint, Active Directory, file sharing solutions like Google Drive and Box, as well as support systems like Zendesk. Put simply, Igloo is an intranet that you're actually going to like. Try it for free. All you have to do is go to igloosoftware.com/twit. Or sign up for a live demo, and you'll see it in action for yourself. When you sign up through our link, you can get your own Igloo for up to 10 people absolutely free for as long as you want. Just go to igloosoftware.com/TWIT, and we thank Igloo for their support of Tech News Today. All right, if you have an iPhone, do you have an iPhone, Father Robert?
I have one on a shelf somewhere.
Okay, well, you probably want to turn it on and get the patch that's rolling out today. You probably got a patch today if you have one. Highly suggest you accept that update right away. It closes a significant zero-day vulnerability that was recently unearthed. Joining us to pick apart the patch, say that three times, and what led to it is Lorenzo Franceschi Bicurai. How's it going, friend? How's it going, Lorenzo?
Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing really good. It's good to have you back finally. So tell us a bit about who this targeted initially and how it was discovered.
The reason why we know about this is because Ahmed Mansour, the original target, did not click on the link that got sent to him and got suspicious and sent a message to Citizen Lab, who were able to then analyze the malware and find out that this was essentially, you know, a government grade hacking tool.
So what kind of access would this give to the attackers that were using it? Is it just like the whole kit and caboodle when it comes to an iPhone?
Yeah, essentially completely unfettered access. Wow. The researchers both at Citizen Lab and Lookout looked at this and if you look at the descriptions, the attackers could intercept SMSs, iMessages, calls, emails, you know, essentially they were the owner of the iPhone.
Wow.
For all intents and purposes.
Yeah, I mean, Lookout even said this, they said in their post about this, that this is one of the most sophisticated exploits targeting mobile phones today. Is that an overstatement? I feel like, you know, on iOS, we don't hear about this so much. I'm an Android user. feel like you hear about exploits all the time, but so when it happens on iOS and it's such a big deal that Apple then decides to push out a patch to address it immediately, I think it took them like 10 days to do this, it seems like a bigger deal. Is that an overstatement on Lookout's part, or is it a pretty big deal for all users?
I think that it's fair. I mean, I don't know if it's a big deal for all users. I guess, you know what, you know, as we quoted when Dan Guido in our story, who's a security expert, who's done a lot of work with Apple. And what he basically told us is that, look, this is not something that did not exist before. We just didn't know about it, right? What this means for iPhone users and other mobile users, though, is that, you know, like basically the story here is that if someone really wants to get into your phone, and that someone is a government with a lot of money, like the UAE government, let's say, then they probably can, and they probably have the means to at least try, like in this case.
Mm-hmm. Lorenzo, can we go a little technical on the actual exploits used? Because I know they used actually 3 zero-days in order to make this work. What were the 3 zero-days that they used, and exactly how did they interact in order to give the attacker complete access to the phone?
Yeah, essentially, yeah, as you said, there were 3 zero-days, which is also like pretty, you know, like, I've covered like government spyware for a while, and it's actually kind of an assumption for people that don't believe that government spyware is a huge problem for people like activists or journalists. They say that 0 days are, you know, governments just don't use 0 days for journalists or activists. In this case, they did. And so, yeah, the 3 zero-days essentially work together. They're what's called like a exploit chain. The first one exploited Safari. The second one then exploited some other like protections within the iPhone operating system. And the third one then got access to the entire kernel. And that way, you know, as we said, that they gave complete access to the phone.
Wow. So that's like two pivots within the operating system in order to make this work. That's really sophisticated. Now, we know that this is a large entity, the NSO group. Is this a type of attack using this many 0 days that you could expect from smaller groups, or are we talking more state size attackers?
Yeah, I think smaller groups, you know, it's hard to know, right? But we haven't seen an attack like this in the wild. So everything that we could say about, you know, this is all speculation, essentially. Like, you know, if we talk about smaller groups, other groups, who knows? But, you know, if NSO can do it, then other people can. But NSO, as you said, is a large group. We don't know much about them, but they have a reported valuation of $1 billion. They were acquired last year or 2 years ago for $120 million. You know, this is not your average, like, Russian criminals gang or Romanian criminals gang, right? They work for governments. They work for, like, people with a lot of money. They have time on their hands, and they're, you know, it's basically their full-time job to do this. So I think that probably tells you a lot.
Yeah, I think what I find interesting about this for in just the sense of, you know, the average person's security, you know, that side of things here is that this was, you know, operated in a way that any of us could fall victim, right? You get a text message. It has a compelling headline or a compelling, you know, collection of words that appeals directly to you, and a link on which to click. Thankfully, in this case, the person who, you know, was targeted here was very suspicious because he'd been targeted in the past, so he didn't click it. Instead, he passed it on to researchers. But I mean, that's something that can happen to anybody, right? You get these weird calls or these weird messages out of nowhere, and I imagine it would be very easy for anyone to see something and be like, well, I'm interested in what that is. Even though you don't know where it's coming, you click on it and boom, your phone is entirely owned by somebody else.
You know, this does remind me a little bit of the situation we had last year with Stage Fright on Android, mm-hmm, which, yes, by the way, is still an exploit in the wild because there are phones, millions of phones that will never get patched. But Lorenzo, I wanted to get your input on this. One of the things that the guys at Zimperium Labs said when we interviewed them was that this was enabled because they were trying to be good citizens of the internet. They took an exploit, a 0 day, that should have been worth millions of dollars, and they sold it to Google for $1,337. But that's not always going to happen. You're not going to get a lot of researchers who are just going to take something that could be worth many, many figures and do it out of the goodness of their heart, turn it loose into the public. What needs to happen so that more security researchers have an incentive to do the right thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really tough question. I mean, in some cases, it comes down to ethics. You know, if you're a researcher and you do this work and you find something like that, it really comes down to what do you want to do with it? You know, do you want to sell it to a company that's based in Israel, which, you know, they claim to do legal things, but then do you know who they're selling to? And do you know who their customers are targeting with this tool, right? Like, there's so many steps in this story, right? You find a vulnerability, then you give it to an Israeli company. Who knows who they give it to? Who knows what these guys are doing with it? So I think for more incentives, you know, what Apple did earlier this summer, like just 3 weeks ago, was announce a bug bounty program giving like really large amounts of money for researchers that found stuff like this and reported it to Apple rather than selling it to NSO or, you know, the Zerodiums or other companies like that of the world. That can help, but, you know, ultimately I'm afraid that it might just come down to the ethics of the people working in this industry.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing is these exploits, they're always going to be there. So it's just a matter of who knows that they exist and what do they plan to do with them before, you know, they are caught by someone who actually has some sort of ethical bone, you know, to report it as opposed to just exploit it or make a whole lot of money off of it. Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchierai, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us about this a little bit tonight. Really appreciate it. Tell people where they can follow all of your awesome work online.
Yeah, I'm on motherboard.vice.com or on Twitter. I can be found at Lorenzo FB.
Excellent. Thanks again, Lorenzo. Have a wonderful night.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Jason. Bye.
All right. TNT's fan of the day is Evan Harris. We know Evan. He was here this weekend at EHCAU or ECHA, I guess, on Twitter, who sent us this video saying, just for fun, watching TNT on my iPad Pro while floating in the pool. Danger is my life, he says. Evan was he was here for the grand opening of the Eastside Studio this weekend. He even got to ride on the trolley from the Brick House to the new studio before we recorded Twit.
He is actually the only super fan who actually helped us build.
Yeah.
He was here overnight.
He was here working.
Us put it together. So
It was truly everybody was pitching in, including Evan. So we thank you, Evan, and thanks for sending that in. And I hope your iPad didn't take a swim. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Record a video, take a picture of yourself, your setup, your pool, your iPad, whatever you have. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it. All right, up next, some really big fans of the Prisma app make their music video memorable, and it's really cool. But first, let's take a minute to thank Blue Apron. They're the sponsor of this episode. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Also, they plan to, you know, support a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Every meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. So you're going to save time. You're going to save money. If you didn't know, shopping at the grocery store is 60% more expensive than what you're going to get with Blue Apron. And if you spend a lot eating out or at high-end grocery chains, you're going to spend even more. You can now spend under $10 per person for healthy home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Customize recipes every week based on your dietary preferences and choose a delivery option that fits your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental U.S. and sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the U.S. Seafood sourced sustainably, beef's raised humanely, chickens are free-range, pork is raised naturally, and regenerative farming practices are used for produce. By shipping the exact amount required for the recipe, Blue Apron is reducing food waste, and it makes the recipes simple to do because you have just the right amount of food. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron's going to bring you the very best. Blue Apron not only supports a more sustainable food system, it supports happy and healthy families. Cooking together builds strong family bonds. It's actually a lot of fun, too. And research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. New recipes are created every week by Blue Apron's culinary team, and they're not repeated within a year. Here's the fun part. Spiced pork burgers with goat cheese and cucumber corn salad. There's summer vegetable and quinoa bowl with fairy tale eggplant, shishito peppers, and corn. And then my very favorite, chicken tinga tacos, because that's so much fun to say, with summer squash and tomato salsa. If those sound good to you, then you need to check out Blue Apron. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So do not wait. Visit blueapron.com/twit. And we thank Blue Apron for their support of Tech News Today. Blue Apron is a better way to cook.
Did you just say chicken tiki tacos?
Chicken tinga tacos.
Oh, tinga, because that sounds
chicken
good.
Chicken tinga tacos.
Let's have some of that, please.
I know. Right. I know. It's as good as delicious as it is fun to say. We showed off the neural network photo app called Prisma about a few months ago anyways, somewhere around there. It's the app that analyzes the work of famous artists and then paints your own photos with the rules that it learned from that analysis. And the results are awesome, some incredibly convincing interpretations. And it was only a matter of time before someone decided to go long form with the work from Prisma. In this case, a Dutch band called Drive Like Maria recorded a music video for their song Deep Blue, but used Prisma frame by frame to turn their music video into something original. And honestly, it looks really cool.
How long did that take? That's frame by frame. Oh, my goodness.
All right. So there's three members of the band. And the music video had a total. So they shot the music video ahead of time, right? They shot it
right,
and edited it.
Right.
And then when they had their final music video, it had a total of 1,828 frames. The band split up the Prisma work into around 600 frames for each of the three band members. Apparently, it took about, or at least they estimated it would take about 5 hours per person to process them. So in order to do this properly, you know, they had to kind of have them sorted properly. They had to be very methodical. And apparently, within the process, the Android version released. So they had both iOS and Android, so they were able to do some simultaneously. But again, you still have to keep the order in mind so you don't, it doesn't fall out of order and it totally throws off all your work.
Oh my goodness.
So they did all that, and I don't know. It's a pretty cool outcome.
I like this. I mean, I'm going to be honest here. Most of the Prisma stuff that I've seen has been nightmare fuel. This is much nicer. I've seen like dogs with curly cues and faces. No. Do this.
This is cool. I mean, Prisma has some... When you process a photo, I have noticed sometimes it just kind of does look a little fakey or whatever. Yeah. But putting the entire thing in motion on full motion video, it actually works really well.
I want to try this now.
It's kind of Scanner Darkly-ish.
I want to take a short clip and just export each individual frame, process it, and then bring it back in. Just to see what it would look like.
That's a know-how you should do.
Like, it is definitely a know-how.
Know-how or something. Mm-hmm. I do wish that they had maybe... Like, if they had different scenes in their video, they could have gone to a different filter for that scene or whatever. The whole thing is that one filter.
Did they mention who the artist was that they were there? All the frames were based off of?
They may have, this article on the MarySue.com may have mentioned what the filter was, and I didn't see.
It would be trippy if they divided the video and they kept switching artists.
Yeah.
You know, this is what a cubist looks like. This is what it looks like when you're doing dadaism or whatever.
Or like, for all the footage where they're in the room jamming, it's one, and then they do a flashback and that's in another one, you know, like a sketch art or whatever. I don't know. Anyways, cool outcome.
I'm just saying, yellow gold video. You could totally do this.
The problem is it's already done.
Right.
You're going to do this and you want to get maximum exposure, you got to be the first one to do that. All right. Well, thanks to Father Robert Ballester. Thank you so much for jumping in.
Always
in Megan's
pleasure.
Absence. Really appreciate it. What are you working on other than giving me this Acer Chromebook 14 as well as the 11, right?
Yeah, we thought you should play with a couple of different Chromebooks.
All right. Yeah. So I got this one. I'm going to play around with it.
Well, it's going to be a crazy know-how schedule for the next month or so because I'm going away. I got to go to Rome, and we're doing a lot of live events here and there. So we're trying to pre-record as much as possible. We've got some back-to-school episodes coming up, including with you and Megan.
Yes.
Giving us your favorite Android and iOS picks for students who are returning to their respective campuses. We're also moving into hydroponics, so anyone who wants to grow with nothing but water and nutrients, we've got a little bit of something for that. Beyond that, we've got a series on brewing beer, so that should be a lot of fun. As well as Aaron Newcomb coming on to help us do some stuff from his maker shop. So it's going to be a very interesting couple of months for know-how.
Fantastic. All right. Make sure and follow twit.tv/KH for know-how and Padre SJ on Twitter. Or just watch Twit. If 5 days a week.
Yes, and I'll be there.
You'll see Father Robert roaming around.
Even when I don't have a show, you'll see me in the background and just kind of
making drinks
shots.
behind us at the bar. Yeah. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsTodayTV. Let's see. What else? Subscribe to the show, maybe. twit.tv/TNT. All the information's there. If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at Jason Howell. And we've got a lot of thanks today. It keeps getting bigger and bigger. Thanks to our technical director, Kara Cole. Thanks to Kim for running the words on the screen. Thanks to Kevin, because he feels like he needs to be thanked. But seriously, thanks to Kevin for always doing a great job editing the show. Oh, and while we're at it, thanks to Tony Wang, who preps the guests for the show, among many other things. I like to call Tony the Creeper. This picture is his response to his How I Watch from yesterday. Do you have that? There he is, creeping. Not a creeper at all, right? I'm a little scared. But there you go. Tony's awesome. And I almost forgot to thank you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody. Whoa.